I think we have some credibility. I think we try to lead by example. I think this is what we're known for. I think it's an advantage of being militarily non-aligned, never having been a colonizer to begin with. We have a great deal of support and credibility, and that I think helped us to be elected to the Security Council, and we try to live up to that. We have said, for example, that we talk directly with member states, not only about them. We want to make it open and more transparent, also how the Security Council works, and we, in a way, as a small country can do, we are still doing our best.
Margot Wallström has been the Swedish foreign minister since 2014, a milestone in a political career with the centre-left Social Democratic Party that stretches back to the 1970s. The politician first entered Swedish parliament at the age of 25 and was appointed Minister for Consumer Affairs, Women and Youth in her 30s, just under a decade later. Wallström went on to become Minister of Culture and later Social Affairs before being appointed to the European Commission in charge of shaping EU environmental policy, rising to become Vice President under José Manuel Barroso. Over the decades, Wallström has focused on issues surrounding sexual violence and conflict for the UN, as well as being a fierce and outspoken defender of gender equality in her country as well as overseas. As Sweden's foreign minister, she also achieved a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council for her nation. Unafraid to speak her mind, Wallström has occasionally irked a few nations due to strong moral stances, which has meant having to smooth a few ruffled feathers in Saudi Arabia and being banned from visiting Israel after she pushed through Swedish recognition of Palestine. I'm pleased to say Margot Wallström joins me today from the United Nations HQ in New York City for the big interview. Margot Wallström, an absolute pleasure to have you here in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I think, first of all, I want to ask you, early in your career, you worked for a regional TV network before launching into politics. What made you decide that politics was, in fact, your calling?
It was already my calling before working on a local, or actually sort of starting a local TV network. It was a neighbor who asked me if I wanted to join a local branch of the Social Democratic Youth Movement, and that's how it started. No tradition from home, but I don't know, she maybe saw in me a very stubborn person that could could do some work in politics. I gave 100% to everything, so from then on, it has been a lot of political activities.
So that was a kind of awakening moment for you?
You know, in those days, it was really very practical things that we were occupied with. I mean, like getting a place for young people to be, and the buses to go a little bit later from the city, or mundane things that were important to young people. So not so much world politics. But it was also a decade where I would say international solidarity was the topic of the day, because we were collecting money for the people struggling in Chile against the dictatorship, or of course the Vietnam War was also engaging a lot of young people. So those were political days.
I mean, obviously you've held many different posts, but you were Minister for Consumer Affairs, Women and Youth. Given that you've been such a champion of women's rights, how important do you think that role was in shaping your later career?
Very important. And of course, today I consider it the unfinished business of our time to make sure that women can enjoy the rights, full human rights, that women can have a voice. And I also think for peace and security that unless you engage women, you will not have a sustainable peace. So it has been part of my political activities and career throughout.
And that's what brings you to the UN right now, in fact.
Today, it's definitely one of the topics.
And just kind of, I guess, zooming out a little bit, talking about Sweden, how much of a role model do you believe that your country is when it comes to gender equality, and how much do you think there's still left to do even there?
I think we will be on top of most lists, or among the sort of the top countries on anything that you measure, from women's participation in the labor force to political representation and what have you. And I think we also have women leaders that have been very visible over decades. So that's important. It has to do with, of course, providing basic services in society as well, to make sure that women can enter the workforce. You need to have childcare, and you need to make sure that women, of course, get education, proper education throughout, and also enjoy other rights, sort of social security in every way. But I think, on the other hand, we share the same problems with many other countries in the world. For example, sexual violence and all of these phenomena. Right now, the whole campaign called Me Too dominates the public debate. This is universal problems.
I mean, talking about the Me Too campaign that's kind of blown up, how hard do you think it is, I guess, searching for those ideals of gender parity when you have someone like Donald Trump in the White House who, at the very least, has come across as sexist in the past?
As a leader of a country, you have a huge responsibility. What you say will encourage or discourage people from doing certain things. And it is problematic if the U.S. is seen as having, or is having, a problem, a president who is misogynist or makes a misogynist statement. So this is remarkable and sad. I think we need men who realize that they have to stand up for also for women's rights. And somebody has said that, you know, feminism is a radical notion that women are human beings. And that's sort of must be the starting point.
When you were elected foreign minister, you said that you would have a feminist foreign policy. What does that mean on a day-to-day basis? What does that mean in action?
It means that we follow three or maybe four R's. First of all, it's a reality check. It's a matter of looking around, saying, is there still discrimination against women? And unfortunately, yes. The answer is yes. So we use the checklist of saying, so okay, first of all, do women enjoy the same rights as men? Meaning legal rights, meaning human rights. Do they enjoy the same human rights as men? Secondly, are they represented? Are they there as elected representatives? Are they there around the table when negotiations are being made? Are they the ones who put their signature under a peace agreement? And thirdly, what about resources? Do we budget resources to the same extent to the needs of women and girls? Or what about resources for women? So if you use these three starting points or three methods to check, then it makes sense to work with a feminist foreign policy. And this is what all our ambassadors do around the world. They look at, so how many, what about education for both girls and boys? What about child marriages? What about legislation that, for example, forbids women from having a credit card or starting a business of their own? What about other pieces of legislation that discriminates? Women cannot have the same jobs as men in many, many countries around the world. And looking at all of these phenomena and saying that we can change that. And we are.
Now, you caused something of a media flurry when you criticize, let's say, Saudi Arabia over its democracy and human rights, using the word medieval. Was that motivated by this feminist foreign policy? What were your reasons for doing that?
No, it was no. The origin of all of this was really when this when a blogger was sentenced to whipping, and this created an outcry in the world. We always defend also free speech and the right to criticize this is what the comment was about. So somebody asked me, so don't you think that these are methods that are medieval? The response to this was enormous from all over the world. So a lot of positive reactions, but of course also Saudi Arabia reacted very, very strongly.
Are you glad it generated such a discussion in a way?
Yeah, I think it was good that it did. I don't fear a lively debate, but we also had to use our sort of diplomatic tools to repair the breach in our diplomatic relations, and everything has been taken care of. But we haven't sort of backed down from our criticism. And we will continue to fight for democracy, human rights, and the rule of law everywhere in the world. We're one of two countries that have made reports on 135 countries where we just look at exactly that, the state of democracy and human rights and rule of law. We have an ambassador for human rights, and we work very actively on those issues.
I mean, obviously, you're a seasoned pro, as it were. But how do you strike that balance between diplomacy and making sure you stick up for the morals and virtues that you believe strongly in?
I think it's a matter of reaching to a point where we sometimes agree to disagree, and we can still continue to talk to each other with respect. And that is also what we had to establish with Saudi Arabia, and we did. And we can talk to each other, and we have sort of normal diplomatic relations. And I am not a person that seeks controversy for the sake of it. I think you just sometimes also have to stick to your ideals and principles, and that's important.
The Guardian, the British newspaper, once called you splendidly undiplomatic. Do you find that frustrating or flattering?
No, that was good. I think it was a good headline. I don't mind.
But I guess you still have to be, you know, a lot of pragmatism comes with your job, I guess. Even if you have issues with one country, you still need to work together with them. For example, the US, you're...
I'm not seeking conflict. I am not at all. On the contrary, I feel that I'm really a person that likes to compromise and find a... I'm very practical. I think that we are here to do something. We're here to make a difference. That's why I am a minister. That's why I'm in politics. I'm here to change things and to have some kind of idea of where I want to go. Not only be at cocktail parties. That is, you know...
Do you think some people, some young people in Europe and probably here in the US, are feeling that politicians aren't representing them well enough, which is why there's been this rise in populism? If so, how do you combat that?
I think there is a lot of mistrust in political leaders, and unfortunately there is too much of corruption, there is too much of political inertia, there is too much of... I don't know, lack of ambition or lack of capability of changing things to the better, and not to mention involving young people, because we've never had so many young people proportionately on this planet as today. So we have a young world, and they want to be taken into account. They want to have a voice. They want to be part of society. And this same thing with women, you know, that they form half of the population on this planet, but if they are not heard, if they are not counted on, then we have a problem.
Now, I want to change tack slightly and look at the European refugee crisis, which peaked a couple of years ago, certainly in terms of media interest. What do you do when there's a dip, and how important is it as a cornerstone of your foreign policy, bringing the world's attention to this ongoing crisis?
We received in 2015 more than 140,000 refugees to Sweden. A big proportion of those were young people, unaccompanied children or teenagers. And we actually received to Sweden 30% of all the unaccompanied minors that came to Europe. And that was also really what sort of created a situation where we said we cannot do it alone, or just a few countries together with Germany and a few others. We were those who received an enormous number of refugees in one go. And we have a policy where we want to integrate them, and also to those who have a right to have asylum in Sweden should also enjoy the same rights as any Swedish citizen. And for these young people, it was a matter of getting them to school, to have to take care of them fully also. So it became problematic. And we think that all the other EU countries will have to share that responsibility with us, and we insist on that. So it meant also in the end that we had to sort of control our border better, but we still receive between 500 and 700 people every week.
But you agree with the tightening of rules?
Well, we had to do that, and we had to do it also to insist that the others, this is a shared responsibility. If we had sort of distributed more evenly among EU countries, it wouldn't have been a problem to anyone. We can manage. We have to insist on creating those rules.
And what do you think it would take for that responsibility to be better shared?
No, well, we are on the way to establishing such a system. We are not there yet, but at least it is a bit better.
And what do you think, as Foreign Minister, you can do to help this situation? Obviously, you know, conflicts are the major cause of refugee crises. What can you do personally, do you think?
Well, we have to address the root causes, and that has to do with everything from fighting poverty to fighting sort of terrorism and how that is spreading around the world. Very often, this is also disappointed young people from many parts of the world who they feel that it's hopeless, that they don't see a future for themselves, they don't have access to education, they don't find a job, and of course they will go somewhere else. They will try their luck in another country.
Traditionally, Sweden has not looked to flex its muscles too much. It's a small nation. What role does Sweden want to play on the global stage?
Well, somebody has called us a humanitarian superpower instead, and that's I think it's a fine fine word, and that is of course where we are big. We are a huge donor to the UN system, to the UN bodies, and we have always had a very generous development assistance around the world. I think this is good. That helps us to secure Sweden as well. We will all be safer if we have confidence building measures, if we have peace building measures, if we contribute to take away the underlying reasons for people to either start a war or actually flee their country. And we have to find partners in all of that.
Sweden nonetheless no longer calls itself neutral. Is it fair to still say, too, that it's non-aligned?
Yeah, we are militarily non-aligned, but we do cooperate. And that's the way forward for a small country like us. I mean, the security policy rests on sort of these three legs. So one, insisting on continuing to be militarily non-aligned. Secondly, that we also invest in our own defense, and that has always been a part of being, you know, the other side of being militarily non-aligned. We also have to demonstrate that we are willing to protect our and defend our country. We are doing that, and we are, for example, introducing conscription again, and we didn't like it when it was by the previous government when it was finished, but we are introducing that. And the third element is, of course, cooperation. We have bilateral cooperation, but also with NATO, but we don't want to end up under the sort of the nuclear umbrella. We believe that this has served us very well for 200 years, and we think that this is also keeping us safe from now on.
So you're ruling out ever joining NATO?
Well, this government has clearly declared that we will not join NATO.
Okay. I mean, you talked just now about conscription, and I think last month you conducted your biggest military exercise in over two decades. And you now have a garrison, for example, stationed on Gotland, on the island, the strategically important island of Gotland. Maybe you can tell me, with all these changes, how this is a shift, perhaps, in foreign policy and your role in the world.
It's not a shift, but it is for the first time that such a big exercise was being done. And of course, today you have to make sure that you can find a cooperation with other countries that we have, for example, bilateral agreements with. We know that if something happens in our neighborhood and around the Baltic Sea, we will probably in one way or the other be drawn into that or affected by it, even though we do not see that there is a direct military threat to our country. This is a good thing to do, to practice. And it was a long time ago, but now we see also that we've had much more of a provocative behavior by, for example, Russia to our neighbors and in and around the Baltic Sea. And it makes it necessary.
I mean, you say there's no direct threat, but you seem to be taking an interest as a nation in how Russia is acting in Crimea and the Ukraine. You don't see it as a direct threat?
No. It's not a direct military threat to Sweden. And we seem to agree on that, or from the military and defense, Department of Defense, to the army and others. But we realize that we are so close to, for example, the Baltic states, and they have, of course, seen sort of a very pure provocations from Russia. If something happens to them, that will also affect us. And we will show solidarity to them.
So you see yourself kind of forging closer relationships with the Baltic states in the future?
Well, we are all EU members. And that is why we don't call ourselves neutral any longer, because we belong to the European Union. And we have also promised to show solidarity to each other. We helped France when they were attacked, when they had a terrorist attack. And we will also stand up for our neighbors around the Baltic.
And what do you make of, for example, incidents involving Russia and incursion into airspace, for example?
We are trying to deal with those things, and we publish, for example, as soon as there is such an incident, we publish it, and it is not only Russia, to be fair. So this is these are examples of the things that have happened lately that we haven't seen before, and there will be a response from our side as well.
Okay, and what for you are the sort of areas of deepest concern as foreign minister that you need to watch and work hardest in, be it Syria or Turkey, who was holding one of your nationals recently?
When it comes to Russia, I think you have to have two sort of time perspectives on that. The first one is to have an immediate, as we've had, an immediate response to the fact that they illegally annexed Crimea, and that the kind of aggression that they show and the military activities in eastern Ukraine, supporting the separatists in eastern Ukraine. And that includes decisions on sanctions, and we are supporting that. We work to uphold that system. The long term, Russia will remain a big and powerful neighbor in the East, and we will have to establish people-to-people contacts. That is, again, it is also confidence building between us. We have worked on making sure that the military can talk to each other directly, so to avoid mistakes or misjudgments on things that could create a development that is very negative. So we are trying on all these fronts, and you have to think more long term about those actions. But we have to do both, and we are. And that has been, I think, good for us as well, because it calms down things and we can talk directly to each other. I've been to Russia, I meet my counterpart and my colleague now and then. So, I mean, that is also how we best keep Sweden and the Swedes safe and secure.
And Syria, obviously Russia is heavily involved in what's happening in Syria. Do you see a solution happening to that terrible conflict in the short term, at least?
Well, it has been going on for so many years now with an enormous suffering, and it has become the playground for all kind of interests and parties. And this, of course, has to come to an end. And it is also, unfortunately, a failure of the international community and the Security Council. Because of the system of veto, we have not been able to make decisions that could have stopped this immense suffering. I really hope that we are at least starting to see the end of this conflict. But we have thought that before, and we've heard so many promises about the ceasefire and humanitarian assistance and all of that, and a political process. But we continue to support the Geneva process and a UN-led peace process. So, and of course, also to make sure that there is accountability for the kind of war crimes that have been committed, and for example, the chemical attacks. And it's good that we're on the Security Council. We will insist on exactly that, accountability for crimes against humanity.
Indeed, you've got another year or over a year left as a temporary member on the Security Council. What do you want to achieve while you're on the Security Council, and how important, given what you were saying about the veto, is reform of that Security Council?
We have two overarching priorities. The first one is to make sure that the United Nations works more on conflict prevention. That can have to do with, for example, a horizon scanning, even when it comes to climate change, because climate change can be the source of conflicts over land or water. It makes people leave parts of their country and then there will be conflicts over land, and you know, it escalates and can lead to war or conflict. So this is important, and how you report from the field about this phenomena. Then we have also said that the Women, Peace and Security agenda is definitely one of our priorities. So our ambassador keeps asking in the Security Council, where are the women? Are they mentioned in the mandates or renewal of mandates? Are they there as peacekeepers? Are they there around the table where peace is negotiated and agreed? And then UN reform is crucial, and also one issue that we're passionate about, to help support Antonio Guterres, the new Secretary General, and to make sure that we see, although we know it will take time, it's not done tomorrow, to take small steps in reforming both how the UN works today, but also think about how do we, for example, restrict the use of the veto, so that you cannot use it when it comes to risk of crimes against humanity or very, very serious war crimes.
And do you hope in a way that you can impart some of the best things that Sweden does on the UN while you're in the Security Council? Those issues of democracy or gender equality, for example.
Yeah, I think we have some credibility. I think we try to lead by example. I think this is what we're known for. I think it's an advantage of being militarily non-aligned, never having been a colonizer. To begin with, we have a great deal of support and credibility, and that I think helped us to be elected to the Security Council, and we try to live up to that. We have said, for example, that we talk directly with member states, not only about them. We want to make it open and more transparent, also how the Security Council works, and we are, in a small way, as a small country can do, we are still doing our best.
Okay, final question, just to give us an idea of the non-stop job of a Swedish foreign minister. Can you just give us an idea of your packed schedule and where you're off to next?
I'll be here until Tuesday, and then I leave immediately to Finland, and we have the Nordic. We meet very often in the Nordic Minister of Foreign Affairs, and then, of course, back to the ministry, and then the next trip, I think, is to Vietnam and Myanmar. Because it's the ASEM meeting, so it's a constant traveling, of course. Between those trips, I have to go to the parliament to answer to questions and be in debates. But it is, of course, a meaningful job and an important job, and not one day like the next. So it's also fascinating, and it gives you hope as well that we can actually change the world if we decide to do that.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Minister Wallström.
Thank you.
The Big Interview is produced by Guy Lutz and edited by George McDonough. I'm Ed Stocker. Thank you very much for listening.